Hey guys, welcome to the Tipsy Archives. I'm your host, Rachel Leagy, and in this episode, my friend Aaron Redekop and myself, we talk about the idea of collections as art, and the idea of art as being archival. We discuss the collection show that's up right now at the Museum of Vancouver, and we'll give you some details on that throughout the podcast. Definitely go check it out. And we also had some fun talking about things that we collect and we would like to collect, you know, if we were millionaires. As we were recording, we enjoyed some delicious wine from Orofino Wineries, which we visited over the summer. So I hope you enjoy. Okay, I'm pretty sure that today was like the hottest day of the year.
It was so hot. I am so glad that we are in your basement and not my apartment, because my apartment is scorching.
Yeah, initially we had talked about recording in Aaron's place, but it is so freaking hot that we decided that my cool dungeony basement would be a better idea.
It's a much better idea. My place would have had the fan on, and you would have heard all of this fan noise in the background, too. And
well, now that we have this excellent new microphone that I used on the last recording, which was great, you will probably pick up on the buzzing of my crappy fridge, or potentially my landlord's upstairs.
So there may be some background noise.
But hey, this is amateur podcasting at its best.
And you'll get to hear our wine. It'll be exciting.
Exactly. Okay, so Aaron, so far you and I and the other guests that have come on the show, we have mostly talked about things like historical events or historical figures.
Yeah.
But we also want to talk about, you know, arts and culture, and art is something that's very important to us. So recently you invited me to an exhibition called All Together Now, Vancouver Collectors and Their Worlds.
Yes, it's a fabulous exhibition that's on at the museum at which I work, the Museum of Vancouver, and it explores collections and also the collectors themselves and the process of collecting.
So I was really inspired to talk about the concept of collecting in archival artwork in general, because it's something that definitely gets me excited. I love looking at collections. I enjoy collecting things. I have previously in school written about the archival nature of art. And so, yeah, it just seemed like something that we both really wanted to talk about.
It's a perfect topic for both of us, because we're both really interested in it, and I think we're both very passionate about that kind of subject matter.
And oh my god, do I love organizing things.
You really do.
Alphabetizing, you know, like all that stuff just gets me really excited. But I mean, it's funny, because some artwork and shows and exhibitions about collections are very organized, like the one at the Museum of Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
You know, where you have all these different collections from private collectors. You got rock posters, toys, pinball machines, taxidermy, and they're all very well organized. And sometimes you see these kinds of shows that are just absolute chaos.
Yeah, you walk into the room and it's overwhelming. You can't figure out where to put your eye. You can't really figure out what's going on.
So there's definitely really different ways to do this kind of work or these kind of shows.
Yeah, and the one at the museum, I'm so proud of it. I don't actually work in the curatorial side of anything. I work in the fundraising department, but it's so exciting to have this show on that really looks at a different side of arts and culture and explores what goes on when you build a collection, maintain a collection, and even when you have to get rid of a collection. It's about letting go as well. And then also bringing it all together, because they're so distinct. Like, each of those collections would not be something that you typically see pictured with the other collection. And yet, the exhibition really flows together. And I find that really fascinating, and I think the curators did a fabulous job on that.
So did they put out a call to have people, you know, apply to have their collections involved?
They did. So the exhibition actually started with Major James Matthews. He is considered the first Vancouver historian. He lived in the 1800s, and he started collecting Vancouver memorabilia, Vancouver, well, it wasn't history at the time, but things about Vancouver at that era. And so it was originally just going to be an exhibition about that. And then it grew from beyond that. And so they put out a call to different Vancouverites to send in what they collected. There was a form that they had to fill out and talk about it. And then
I can only imagine all the different types of collections people must have submitted.
Oh, I know. That was about a year and a half before I worked there, but I would have loved to have gotten to see that. And even some of the ones that are in the exhibition right now, like there's the prosthetic eyeballs, there's prosthetic limbs.
That's my favorite one. I love that one. Like, there are so many things that I enjoyed. The drag costumes, the taxidermy. Yeah. But I think the prosthetic limbs are my favorite because I do have, you know, I do love the 19th century and, you know, antique sort of medical devices are very fascinating to me.
Yeah.
So that was a very cool part of it.
It's a really neat one. And because I work there, I was lucky enough to go on the staff tour of the exhibition. And it's really interesting with that one because it's not just the prosthetic limbs and being a collection. It's also sort of like the medical advancements that came from that because he actually creates prosthetic limbs. And so it's really neat to see what came out of somebody collecting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure a lot of collectors probably get involved because maybe it comes up through their work or something like that.
Yeah. Well, the seed collector in the exhibition, his name's Harold Steves, and that's actually where Steveston comes from.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, there's parts of that show that I went through the whole thing, and I don't even remember. I need to go back, actually, and look it over again.
It's definitely one that you need to go back and explore. And I'm not just saying that because I work in the membership department.
So, I mean, that really brings us to sort of the idea of why are collections so appealing to us, like, as a society or, you know, as individuals? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons why people collect. People collect because they're passionate about a subject matter. There are people who collect because they think it's their duty to collect, because collection is about the preservation of history. And I think that surrounding yourself, like in my mind, I think surrounding yourself by things that you enjoy is a big part of a collection. And that's always been sort of my driving force for anything that I've collected.
I've sort of always felt that way with, I mean, we're sitting in my home right now, and you look around, and you see, like, I have a lot of stuff.
You do, and you have a lot of, like, collectible stuff, too. And it's not a typical collection, either. Like, there's not much that you collect in your home that is something that somebody else would necessarily collect.
I do feel like with collections and with your space, you know, you are curating your own space all the time, and it is something that's a reflective of your personality and who you are and your interests. And actually, I just remembered that I kind of made a joke a few months ago that my personal design aesthetic is metaphysical bookstore.
Ah, yes. I can totally see that.
There's a lot of, like, religious items and bones and crystals and books and things like that, so.
It's a really neat space to be in.
Yeah.
And your partner collects things as well.
He does. One of the shelves against the wall is completely covered with War Machine figurines.
That's what I'm looking at right now. That's where it came to me. And so it's really neat.
So, I mean, that's a whole other thing of, like, you know, pop culture collection, toy collectors. And I think that with pop culture especially, that's really, you know, brought, like, a whole new aspect of collecting, because you have people who are, you know, getting records, I mean, and that's preserving a piece of history.
Yeah.
Or even just CD collections because you love music, or movie collections, or, I mean, it's just kind of, the list goes on and on.
It really does. Well, and if you think about back when we were kids, the Beanie Baby craze, where everybody was collecting those, and even, like, right now, Pokemon Go is a huge thing. Like, I'm playing it. I know you're not. But that's, like, literally what I do in my spare time. Sometimes on my lunch break, I'm going out and I'm collecting something. And it's, like, it's not even a physical collection anymore. It's a digital collection. And it's a game collection. But it's still collecting.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's definitely a real aspect of nostalgia when it comes to collections, whether it's our own personal ones or we go and we look at these curated shows, that, you know, we live in such a digital age and it's such a consumer culture that to see these collections put together with such care and to represent, you know, our childhoods or earlier than that, it connects us to something and it makes it physical.
Mm-hmm. And we want that connection. And you see that in so many, like, throwback nights or theme restaurants that have, like, there was the restaurant on Main Street that closed a couple years ago, Rumpus Room, that was...
I never got a chance to go there.
It was really neat, and so you walked in and it was like a 70s basement.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It was great. Apparently there's a place on Main that's called Uncle Abe's that's very similar to what Rumpus Room was like, but I haven't been there yet.
Actually, funny story, I might have to just give her a little bit of a shout out, but I know the owner.
Oh, really?
Both of those places. Not well, but we used to go on holidays together when we were kids.
Oh, that's really
neat. Yeah. Hi, Rachel.
That's super cool.
Yeah, and Monkey Gone to Heaven on Main, too, is her store.
Oh, really? Yeah, so that's awesome.
We're doing a little advertising for you.
Today is all about that.
Clearly, she has great taste.
Well, and the Rumpus Room was really neat because it was literally like stepping into a 70s basement, and I wouldn't say it was like full on collecting, but they had a selection of board games that you could play, and a lot of people collect board games there.
So it's about creating an atmosphere.
It is in many ways, and I think sometimes a collection does branch into that or evolve into that.
I was doing a little bit of reading, and I didn't get a chance to read his whole paper, but of course, every time I was Googling sort of like collections and archival art, the name Hal Foster came up, and he's an art historian. And he wrote about the archival impulse, saying that it was the need to make historical information that's often lost or displaced physically present.
Right.
So I think that's exactly what we're talking about.
I think that is exactly what we're talking about. And he is a really great person to bring up because he does look at so many different elements of history and culture, and he really breaks it down into ways. Like, I like how he talks in the past about like Karl Marx and Hegel and stuff like that, but then actually gets into actual like tangible art things.
Yeah, and he really talked about how this archival impulse has become quite a big thing in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And how many archival artists there are now, and many of them, of course, being installation artists because you're dealing with a bunch of stuff.
Yes.
So what else are you going to do with it?
Well, and people want to see the stuff, and I feel like audiences engage a lot better when they can actually see what you're talking about and not just, like, an image or a reflection of it.
Mm-hmm. And so we talked about how with the show at the museum, I mean, everything is very catalogs and very organized.
Yeah, there's little sections for each collector, and it talks about what they have collected and a bit about them.
Reading some of this information from Hal Foster about archival artists and installations made me think of another show that I saw last year, which was at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and that was the Jeffrey Farmer Show, How Do I Fit a Ghost in My Mouth? And he is an archival artist who actually refers to himself as an arranger of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's just a totally different type of show. I mean, he's taking his collection of very carefully picked out things.
Yeah.
And arranging them in a way that, I remember I walked into it and I felt like I was, like, walking into, like a storage room. An old, forgotten storage room.
Especially when you walked up the stairs.
Yeah.
It was... So I was really lucky with the Jeffrey Farmer Show. I'm quite involved with the Young Associates of the Vancouver Art Gallery. They're a young professional group. And we got to do a private tour with Jeffrey Farmer. And it was just fascinating because when you walk into the show, the first thing you saw was, I believe it was a reflection on a woman who had committed suicide based on something that happened with her lover or something like that.
You're talking about when you walk into the little round area and go up the stairs?
Yeah.
Well, that was about, so the art gallery is in a courthouse.
Yes.
And it was, I thought it was a murder.
Yeah, it was. It was a murder-suicide thing.
Yeah, but it had to do with a lawyer or a judge who actually worked in the courthouse when it first opened. So it was about the history of the building. It was, I can't quite remember the exact story, but it was very interesting that he tied in the history of the building into the entrance of the show.
Yeah.
And so that was really neat.
Well, and he had a personal link to the building because his dad
had worked there.
As a lawyer.
Yeah.
And so that was... Also, because I believe it might have been one of his dad's cases, but I could be making that up at this point.
No, I think it must have been much older than that. I think that was, like, the initial yeah. case he was talking about.
Yeah.
It's been a year, so excuse us for not having the details. But so then, like, you go into the upstairs part and you walk in, and it's just literally like, I mean, and I think he even tried to have things collect dust, you know?
Yeah.
So that it looked like, you know, things hadn't been disturbed, and it's just like coat hangers and bottles and just all kinds of things. And but it kind of, like, right away really, like, gave me a sense of comfort.
It really did. Like, you felt like you wanted to spend time in there. And as somebody who had frequented the art gallery a lot, I found it really interesting because it really transformed the space. And it became such a unique place to be mm-hmm. and a unique setting. And I didn't even feel like I was in the same building that I had been in, you know, 3 or 4 months before that when mm-hmm. I'd gone on the last tour. And so he had a number of shelving units set up, as Rachel had mentioned, and there were all kinds of photographs and books, and it was actually even hard to walk around it.
Yeah, you kind of would go into an area and think, like, am I supposed to go over here?
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's that part where there was a door that I wasn't sure if you were supposed to open or not, but that's part of the exhibit.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, the room full of stuff arranged on a stage where just crazy sounds were playing.
Oh, the Zappa room?
The Zappa room.
Yeah, the Zappa mm-hmm. room was, it was kind of like going, like, you felt like you were in some kind of 70s drug trip when you walked into that room. But he's collected so many things, and there's also a room that was a digital collection too, because he had the Vancouver Library digital collection.
Yeah, I think I missed that part. I was there because I had to write a paper on the show for mm-hmm. my modern art class that I was taking.
Right,
and I do remember the room. The last, I have the name of the room. It's like the surgeon. The surgeon and the photographer, which was the last one of the last rooms that had all the puppets.
Oh, that room was so hard to walk through.
It was hard to walk through, but what he had done was all the puppets, other than I think the cloth they were made out of, were cut up of pieces of books from McLeod's books.
Yep.
And he had been in McLeod's, which if you're from Vancouver and you've been in McLeod's books downtown, it's just like, it also is like being in another world. I mean, and this is, you know, talk about a collection of books.
My husband calls it Narnia.
Yeah, it's like you walk in and there's books just piled on the ground, to the ceiling. You feel kind of like you might die at any second because an entire shelf might fall on you.
Yeah.
It feels very precarious and like you have no idea what time period you're in.
You are shocked when you actually find what you're looking for there, but when you do find it, it's amazing. And there's so many magical things that you can find there.
One time I went in there looking for a specific book and I asked the person who worked there, and they pointed to a shelf that was higher, and I said, do you have a ladder or something? And they pointed to a chair, which was so rickety, and I was standing on it, and, like, I thought, this is the most dangerous thing. I can't believe they're just like, yeah, just stand on that broken chair and, like, grab a book off of a high shelf. But, yeah, so Jeffrey Farmer wrote about how he was in there, and he was holding a book in his hand, and how he thought about how books come alive in your hands, and that was why he made these puppets. So it's like you actually have this figure, this character coming alive in your hand made out of pieces of books. So, I mean, you know, that's, I think, carrying forth the idea of, like, collecting little pieces of information and quotes, and, like, it's just a very different way of, you know, him curating his own little archival collection of tidbits and information in a way that's very deconstructed.
I really like that. I had actually not, like, I didn't actually know that about that exhibition.
Yeah, when I wrote the paper, I read a number of articles about the show, and it just kind of actually popped into my brain right now.
That's really neat.
Yeah.
No, that was, that is probably my favorite show. Well, second favorite show that I ever saw mm-hmm. at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
But yeah, just an example of how you can take a similar idea of showing collections or showing, you know, something that is a person's collection and archival, having an archival nature, but in two, like, absolutely completely different ways.
So, so different. And, well, the thing that I found really fascinating about the Jeffrey Farmer show is, in many ways, it felt chaotic, but it was so detail-orientated, and it was so well thought out, and everything was there for a reason. And I guess that's true of an art gallery show. But
and every time he takes a show like that down and puts it up somewhere else, it's not the same.
Oh, it's completely different. And that's such a fascinating aspect of creating a show like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, we see this kind of attention to archival art, like, happening a lot. And as an example, I'll just give a shout-out to my mom. Sarah McDonald, she was just in a show in Kelowna at the Rotary Art Center. The show is called Discarded Lives, An Obsession with Things, and its focus was on hoarding, collecting, and waste. And unfortunately, by the time the podcast goes up, it is going to be over, but I just want to, you know, point out that it's just another example of this kind of focus on collecting and hoarding. And her work actually came from a number of knitting patterns that she had collected. My mom is also a huge collector.
Oh, neat.
Of, like, she just kind of finds bits and pieces of things and, like me, like, puts them in boxes for later.
Yeah.
That she might use for art down the road. And she had, I remember a year or so ago, her saying, I have all these knitting patterns, like these vintage knitting patterns. What am I going to do with them? I'm like, oh, I don't know. So the show came up, and she ended up using these knitting patterns and kind of collaging them and putting them up. And the focus was on gender stereotypes because, of course, there are, like, you know, little boys holding guns with right. their sweaters on, or little girls holding, like, kitchen utensils, and she'd put little captions on them. And so yeah, that was the show she was in recently, and I totally wish I would have been able to see it, but I don't live in Kelowna anymore, so I miss it. But I'm sure I will see the work in person at some point.
I really wanted to road trip up for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the gendered part of collecting is really interesting to me. It just sort of popped into my head right now, because I read an article recently about how collections are often gendered, but also just because of the role that women play in the household and just in general, that women have typically been the people who collect and preserve history.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily professionally, but women are the ones that will catalog, you know, what your children do.
Is it because we're the gatherers?
I think it is because we are the gatherers. And
like,
so
traditionally.
Traditionally, yeah. Like, not necessarily anymore. But how, for the longest time, if you, like, when you look back at history, there is a real, like, gendered way of looking at who is doing the collecting. And also the different types of collecting. Like, men would oftentimes collect, like, coins or, you know, like, army figurines or something like that.
Whereas, or now, like, toys.
Exactly. Whereas women would oftentimes collect things that would showcase your life and catalog
your life.
My
grandma had a collection of those tiny little spoons.
So did mine!
And then also porcelain dolls.
I think my grandmother, it wasn't porcelain dolls, but it was, like, porcelain figurines, and I mm-hmm. still have a couple.
My grandma had those, too.
She also did teacups, but it was really, the spoons were her big one. My husband's grandmother collected plates. Every time she went on vacation, she'd get a plate. Actually, my family does something similar, but not with plates. It's, we collect Christmas ornaments whenever we go somewhere, and so our Christmas tree is not, it's more of like a reflection of our life, and so it's not filled with Christmas ornaments, it's filled with different memorabilia from different places we've gone on trips with each other.
So I wonder how much, and I'm thinking about these things that people collect, like plates, and I mean, this is something breakable. It's difficult to collect things when you don't necessarily have the most, you know, stable living situation.
Well, and they're talking about that, is how millennials are changing the way we collect because we don't have the same amount of space. And so
I just want to go on record and say that I'm not a millennial.
You are technically a millennial. You fall into the age gap, but you are definitely not. I definitely am. I am your token millennial. but, you know, like,
so how are they getting around it? Like, is it smaller things, digital things?
Digital things, mm-hmm. smaller things. I mean, some of us, like myself, I live in 600 square feet, but my parents still have a detached home in Edmonton, and so there are a couple of things that I collected as a child. I collected My Little Ponies, mm-hmm. which, not this version of My Little Pony,
when we were
in
kids.
In the 80s. Yeah, My Little Ponies. I have a Babysitter's Club book collection from when I was a kid. Those are all at my parents' place mm-hmm. in Edmonton because they have a basement and I can store it there.
Yeah, but you think about, I know not everyone, but my sort of perception of, you know, our grandparents, especially like when they were raising their kids in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it seemed like they were so much more stationary, you know, like they could afford to buy a house.
Yeah.
And they could really afford to, like, fill up that house. And they were bigger houses back then. And so they could collect more things if they wanted to. It was easier. But I know since I've been 18 years old, I've moved 20 times, like so many times.
Yeah.
So, and one of the biggest moves I did about 5 years ago was from Kelowna to Vancouver. And I got rid of probably 80% of the books that I owned, probably 80% of the things that I owned. I pared down to the absolute necessities and I got rid of so many things.
Yeah.
And I've done that many times in my life where, as a teenager, I collected lunchboxes.
Yeah.
Like into my teens and early 20s. And that's not a small collection.
No, it, those,
you know, those big plastic ones that split open in the middle.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And have like the buckles on them.
Oh, that would take up so much space.
Yeah. So when I lived with my parents, you know, I could keep that kind of thing in my closet, but, eventually, I just, you know, you can't lug that stuff around with you. And you think about somebody who collects something like instruments or...
Oh.
I mean, it's just, it's really, you have to either be really passionate enough to make it work or be lucky enough or to be able to afford the space.
Yeah. Or to be able to afford a, like, a special type of storage locker. Because you can't just store some of these collections in a regular
storage locker. Unless you're smart and you collect something like coins or stamps and it's not very big.
Yes. But if you collect anything that's larger, but like books, books are so heavy. So I grew up, my parents essentially have a library and I loved having that library and I wanted my own and my husband loves books and we have a lot of books because we're both huge readers, but we find every time we move, we have to get rid of books. And it's really hard to let go, especially of something like a book, where it really becomes a part of you.
It's hard because the books I buy are, like, art reference books, so they're, like, huge hardcover textbook-sized books.
I refuse to get rid of any of those. Yeah. I have used them. I've started to use books for, like, I'll lift up my computer monitor on my books, and I'll try to put them to useful
things. As you notice, since we have the newer mic now, but we had the old one, I used to put it on a stack of books to raise it up.
Yeah.
They're so useful.
They're so useful. They help relieve stains. Recently, I had to relieve a stain out of the carpet, and so I did, like, the vinegar. And, so you put vinegar, and then you put on a piece of paper towel, and then you put saran wrap, and then you pile heavy books on top of it. I got this from my mom, because my dad's a lawyer, and so she used to have this giant Black's Law dictionary that every lawyer has to have. And so we'd pull up stains with it. And so I do it with that, because we don't have a giant book like that. Mm-hmm. It's just with our book collection. It becomes a stain removal.
I recently used a book to help buff the back of the prints I was making while I was doing lino cuts.
That sounds like something you could definitely use a book for. Yeah,
totally.
They're so useful.
The moral is don't ever get rid of your books.
Don't. And I guess the minute you do, you're going to be like, I really want to read this book. Because that happened to me. Because we had to pare down. We moved from like 1,100 square feet to 600 and we had to get rid of a bunch of stuff.
So talking about all the stuff that we love and when to purge and what you want to keep, I mean, that kind of leads into the important question of what's the difference between collecting and hoarding?
Well, there's a great quote, and I'm not going to do it justice because I can't remember the exact words, but it's in the museum exhibition, and it says, it's something along the lines of, it becomes collecting when you're keeping something cool.
Well, I know the event that I went to, which was, and I should have written this word down, but it was about the...
Oh, the, it was about collecting corkscrews.
It's about collecting corkscrews, but they have a word for it.
All right, so I may be pronouncing it wrong, but I believe it's pronounced helixophiles, and that is people who collect corkscrews. And as we learned at that show, there are so many different kinds of corkscrews.
Well, one quote that I wanted, the reason I thought of that, and that was the event that I went to for the All Together Now show, and this couple gave a talk about their corkscrew collection, And, you know, they talked about what they thought the difference between collecting and hoarding was, or collecting, what's the difference between collecting and just having a bunch of stuff?
Yeah.
And it was being active and being passive.
Yes.
It's like, are you letting things pile up in your home, or are you looking for it and looking for specific things, and are you being really active in what you're collecting?
Well, and you mentioned something about that when we were chatting before we even started the recording, about the value of certain pieces in a collection.
I don't necessarily think that it has to have value, but I think it's maybe the difference between, like I had said earlier, you know, is this the toy you need to fill out an entire run of a collection, or do you have three of the same toy and one, and a couple of them are kind of broken? Mm-hmm. Do you really need it, or are you just accumulating them because you can get your hands on them?
Yeah, well, and it's not just like the tangible value, but it's the emotional value of it. Like, is it valuable to you mm-hmm. to really add that additional element? So, I mean, when you talk about, we were talking about corkscrews, and also, you know, is it of value, letting go? I have a wine collection. In the last couple of years.
A revolving wine collection?
It is, and that is the correct term for it. So I have a revolving wine collection, and I don't know.
Which is, I pour myself another
I don't know if that actually would be considered a collection or not. In my mind, it is. Mm-hmm. Because I do actively seek out.
How many bottles of wine do you have in your collection for it to be a collection or.
Yeah.
So, I don't normally have more than like two or three bottles, and that's pretty rare. Normally, I buy a bottle, take it home, and drink it.
So, I used to always be like that. It's only been in, I'd say, like, the last 2-3 years. So, I probably have, like, 20, 25 bottles of wine in my apartment right now.
Oh, I'd say that's a collection.
And so, I think that's a collection, but, like, I do drink them, and, like, there's a few that I'm really attached to, and I have on special occasions. Like, I'll have them on my anniversary. Or we opened this bottle of champagne when I got a new job, and
I think this is very topical for the Tipsy Archives to be talking about.
I think it really is topical. So yeah, like, is that really a collection? I think it is, but I don't always have the same items in my collection.
But if you think about people who, you know, I'm sure there's lots of people that have collections that are constantly acquiring and trading and selling, and their collection doesn't necessarily have to remain static.
Exactly.
So it could just be, you know, that they are somebody who's actively collecting and, you know, wheeling and dealing, as it were.
So I guess I am a wine collector then, because we were having a conversation earlier, Rachel and I, about what we collect, and Rachel collects a lot of things, and I couldn't quite figure out what I collect. And that's where the Pokemon joke came out that I made earlier. So we were like, well, you collect Pokemon.
So if you had the, you know, say, time, money, and space to collect anything, knowing you, I'm sure you would probably collect more art.
I would collect more art. Well, when I grew up, my mom has an art collection. She gets so mad when I call her an art collector, but...
Is that an insult?
Well, I think she just... I don't know what it is exactly, but she gets really mad at me when I call her an art collector. But she has art for every season, and I'm really proud of my mom's art collection, and it's really what...
You mean, like, she changes up the art on her walls?
Well, it's based on season. My mom actually hangs art at gallery level.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, no, it's really neat. My mom used to... Well, she worked in an art gallery, in a private art gallery in St. Albert, mm-hmm. and she used to be a docent at the Edmonton Art Gallery as well, and so we've always had a lot of art. My mom's an art history major. That's really where I got my... Like, my dad's a history major, my mom's an art history major, mm-hmm. and that's where I got my love of mm-hmm. art and culture and history, and...
Oh, I totally understand. I mean, my mom is an artist who's been involved in, you know, multiple shows and galleries and teaching classes, and I'm an artist, and I have had my hand in running an amateur gallery as well, so acquiring... I mean, of course, I don't have, at this point in my life, anything terribly prestigious or expensive, but, you know, anytime I can support friends and add to my personal art collection, mm-hmm. I do, because I love having stuff on my walls. Nothing drives me more crazy than walking into somebody's house who has nothing on their walls.
Oh, it drives me so crazy, and I love filling my art, or my house, with art, and I think it's really important. My walls are definitely not as filled as yours are. But I recently bought my first piece of expensive art. Ooh. I actually had to go on a, like a, what was it? I had to go on a payment plan for it.
That's exciting.
It was very exciting. So it, and it totally fits with the person that I am. It's a piece by a local artist. His name is Michael Miller, and he's represented by Monty Clark Gallery. But he was in the Vancouver Art Gallery art rental and sales, which is where I got the piece from. And I met him at an event that they had, and his personality appealed to me immediately because he's a nerd.
We're going to have to tweet him, too.
We will have to tweet him. I'll look him up. but I chatted with him, and he's a nerd like we are, so he does video game artwork. And awesome. So for my second anniversary with my husband, because we're both really into art, I bought us... It's Zelda hearts, and it's called Full Life, and it's three pixelated hearts.
Is it up in your place?
It is. It's above our computer.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that now.
And so that is the first piece of really expensive art that I've bought that got into four digits rather than two or three, which is what I normally buy art at.
Yeah.
Part of that, I had bought a piece at a silent auction that was... so I bought... I have a few, like...
So I want to just take a minute to say, I mean, this is a bit of a pet peeve of mine. And of course, you know, there's not a lot of people, or sorry, there are a lot of people that maybe don't have a lot of exposure to artists or art that they can afford.
Uh-huh.
But if you want to decorate your home, you know, don't go to HomeSense.
No.
Or somewhere where you can buy generic printed stuff like that, that's, you know, they mass produce by the thousands. You don't have to be rich to buy good art. You can support local artists. You can support somebody you know. You can find stuff online. And even if you can't afford to buy a painting, so many artists out there have prints.
Uh-huh.
And if you buy prints from them, you frame a print, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
And you're still directly supporting an artist. And I definitely really encourage you, as an artist myself, to do that and to support people personally. And then also I think it really shows your personality and your personal style more than picking out something that's super generic.
It really does. And the Vancouver Art Gallery actually has their art rental and sales. And so you can go there, and it's all local Vancouver artists. And it typically, a lot of those works are really quite affordable. Like, there's some really high-end work, but there's some incredible pieces you can get for $100, $70. They do payment plans. And
art, like property, I don't think it's ever a bad investment.
It never is. The piece that I was telling you about is, like, tripled in value since I bought it 3 years ago or 2 years ago.
Great.
So
anything else, you know, kitschy and weird that you would want to collect?
Well, I collect shoes. But, well, it was actually quite hilarious when I changed jobs recently. The thing I was most worried about was having to bring my shoe collection home because my husband didn't realize how many shoes I had.
God, you'd be ashamed. I have, like, four pairs of shoes.
I have a lot. They're not expensive shoes. The number of them come from Payless. But I really like unique shoes, and I really like my shoes to kind of be like art.
Well, it works for all those gallery shows you go to and museum parties you go to. You gotta have good-looking feet.
Exactly. I have to make my wardrobe be a little bit artsy.
There you go.
So, I mean, there's that. Oh, there's so many things I want to collect. There's so many things.
Like, so I collect, I mean, this collection is pretty small, but it's something that I've become rather passionate about and is growing, religious trinkets.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of rosaries and prayer candles, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Catholic or Christian. That is my favorite. For the record, I am not religious, but I love studying religion.
Yeah. Oh, religion's fascinating.
So, I mean, anything sort of... along, like, Catholicism and the Catholic trinkets are my favorite just because they're so beautiful, and you have all the saints and things like that. But really, any religious trinkets or books that I can get my hands on, I totally will add to my collection. I also have quite a decent collection of different rocks and stones that are pretty small, but... smaller because they're cheaper and easier to transport, but, you know, all these amethyst and citrine and stuff like that. I'm a little bit of a hippie at heart, like I said, metaphysical bookstore.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, my own little personal art collection, and What am I forgetting?
I forget what they are called, but I am pointing at them now.
Plants?
No, not your plants.
I also collect houseplants. Funko Pops. Yeah.
Oh, tarot cards. Tarot cards is the other thing that I collect, and haven't been too actively reading for a long time, but to me, they are just in themselves collections of 78 pieces of art.
Yeah.
I mean, you have an artist take their time to make an entire deck of cards, or even playing cards, beautiful playing cards I will buy.
Yeah.
There's so many different and unique sets out there, from comical to absolutely gorgeous to ethereal, different kinds of decorated tarot cards. So that's another thing that I collect, so... Yeah, I mean, like, I love stuff.
I do, too, and it helps that you live in a much larger place than I do.
It's much more basement-y.
It is much more basement-y, but you have a lot more places to put things. For me, we do collect, my husband and I have a board game collection. It's not as elaborate as a lot of our friends have, but that's something that we are trying to build. Something I would love to collect, old manuscripts. When my grandmother passed away when I was 13, I got one of the very early copies of Alice in Wonderland, and it's essential. Oh no, Through the Looking Glass.
You know what I've never shown you that I have? I have an edition of a Rudyard Kipling book, The Jungle Book, I think it is, that is old enough to be pre-World War I when he still had swastikas stamped on all his books.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was back before they had to remove that.
Yeah.
Because he, of course, grew up in India and was familiar with that image, and so...
Yeah, and from a completely different... That's one of the little different
book treasures that I have. But, like, I mean, and that's the thing that, of course, is, like, us as historians, like, love old books, but, oh, expensive.
So expensive. Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about old books is the writing in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that idea that the book isn't just what the author wrote, but the book is the experience that somebody else had with the book.
Mm.
And so you get little notes.
The life the book has had.
Yeah.
Passed from hands to hands.
And I love that. The marginalia, yeah. I love it. I think it's fascinating. And so many people worry about that. But for me, I think I love to travel. And so I love to collect things from around the world. And that's what I used to travel a lot more than I do now. And so I would always try to get something from a different place.
Oh, man, that's where, like, last year, when I was in Italy, rosaries, you know, like, those are always remind me of that trip. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, I think to kind of, like, come full circle again, our own personal collections and, you know, archiving our lives, I mean, it's just a reflection of who we are. And to have physical objects to look at and to hold and to show people just kind of makes those connections stronger and more tangible.
Well, and as historians, that's how we are able to figure out the lives of other people. Mm-hmm. Like, I did classical history, and so because of, like, Pompeii, where people are essentially, like, entombed by the volcano, you actually can see a bit into their lives by the collections. And I feel like it would be very interesting now, because millennials don't collect in the same way. Like, would we leave the same mark that a lot of other cultures have? And would that actually give a better understanding of us? Because do we actually fully understand? Because we look at what people collected, and does that mean we understand them?
Well, I guess maybe I don't know enough about computers, but I do digital files and records still leave the same kind of mark, even if, you know, the hard drive has died. Is it still something that can be, can you find stuff there in the future?
Well, that was one
thing. Maybe they still leave this a similar kind of mark that actual physical objects do. That's something I don't really know much about.
That was something I studied, actually, in my classical degree, was whether, like, how would we mark things? Because in the digital age, like, we store so much digitally. But, like, can we really access, like, what was on, like, a first-generation iPod anymore, or, like, an original computer?
And personally, I have no clue.
I have no clue. And we were asking a bunch of art students to determine that, and we did not know, like, the answer.
I don't know.
And so then we were trying...
Do we want to know what we were listening to when we were 21?
I do, because I still think that music was awesome. I mean, I like going back to 90s nights. Not that I was 21 in the 90s, but...
So I think to kind of, you know, cap things off, we've made it clear how much we enjoy the idea of collecting, personally collecting ourselves, what they mean to people, and what it means to really archive, you know, objects that are important to our lives. So I would definitely, as somebody who has seen the show, encourage people to go check out the show at the museum.
Yes, please come see All Together Now. It is on until Sunday, January 8th, 2017, so you have plenty of time to come see it, but that doesn't mean that you should wait to come see it. And the museum is in Vanier Park in Kitsilano, so it's not hard to get to.
And it's in an absolutely beautiful location if you haven't been to the Museum of Vancouver.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It's right on the water, and it's a really interesting building itself. And we've got a great historical section as well on the history of Vancouver. So
the museum itself was also encouraging people to tweet their collections to the museum, right?
Yeah. Tweet and Instagram your collection.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know the museum Twitter?
So if you want to tell the museum what you collect, you can tweet them. They're at Museum of Van, and just add the hashtag all together now or the hashtag at MOV.
Or if you guys want to tweet at the Tipsy Archives, you can always find us at Tipsy Archives. And I didn't prepare any kind of hashtag, but just tweet at us and let us know. And like anytime ever, we'd love to hear from you.
We always want to hear from you. And we always want to hear from you about what you think we should do next, too. So
let us know. Tell us about your collections or tell us your suggestions for, you know, what you want to hear about. Well, I hope that everyone enjoyed hearing about collections as much as we enjoyed talking about it. Let's cheers.
Well, that concludes this episode of the Tipsy Archives. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And like we just discussed, please feel free to tweet at us or email us and tell us about your collections or any other ideas you have for the show or feedback. You can reach us at thetipsyarchives@gmail.com or on Twitter @tipsyarchives. Thanks again for joining us.